From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Fountains of Wayne, we'll speak to Chris Collingwood and Adam Schlesinger, co-founders of the rock band. They've got a new CD called Welcome Interstate Managers. Also, we meet novelist Scott Spencer. His new book is A Ship Made of Paper. Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new series of DVDs featuring the big production musicals of Bing Crosby. And film critic David Edelstein reviews The Hulk, directed by Ang Lee. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Firefighters in southern Arizona say a big wildfire could spread over tens of thousands of acres. Mark Moran of member station KJZZ says high winds are driving the fire over woodlands dried by years of drought.
The winds have been gusting up to 60 miles an hour, and when the air is so dry and the vegetation is so dry, just tinder dry trees, obviously, it helps that wildfire to spread incredibly quickly.
Firefighters say many of the dry trees have been killed by an insect infestation, and the fire has already destroyed some 250 houses north of Tucson. An investigating officer at Fort Knox, Kentucky, says there's enough evidence to court-martial a soldier charged with attacking his sleeping comrades with a grenade and a rifle. The attack took place last March at an army camp in Kuwait. Kim Cerise reports from member station WFPL.
Investigating officer Colonel Patrick Reinhardt says evidence shows 32-year-old Sergeant Hassan Akbar had enough time to acquire the grenades used in the March 23rd attack and that Akbar's rifle was used to kill one of the two officers who died. Reinhardt says there are reasonable grounds to believe Akbar, a Muslim, committed the offenses that killed two officers and wounded 14 others. Reinhardt's recommendations will now go to Akbar's battalion commander, Lieutenant Colonel Peter DeLuca. DeLuca, who is currently in Iraq, will make the next decision on how the case will proceed, and he has the option to dismiss it. If a court-martial is recommended, it will be ordered by the commanding general of the 101st Airborne. For NPR News, I'm Kim Cerise in Louisville.
Archbishop Michael Sheehan of Santa Fe spoke today about his plans for the Diocese of Phoenix. Sheehan will supervise the diocese until a replacement is found for Bishop Thomas O'Brien, who resigned after being charged in a fatal hit-and-run accident. Chicago Public Radio's Jason DeRose reports from the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops in St. Louis.
Archbishop Sheehan says he'll try to implement the same healing policies in Phoenix he put into place in Santa Fe when he took over that archdiocese in the midst of a sex abuse crisis 10 years ago. At that time, he met with or spoke with all survivors of abuse who came forward. Sheehan has been widely praised by survivors of abuse for his handling of the Santa Fe archdiocese. At a midday press conference in St. Louis, Sheehan pledged to work for the protection of children alongside the county prosecutor in Phoenix. Sheehan says in all the dioceses across the country, bishops and archbishops are trying to make up for the mistakes of the past. For NPR News, I'm Jason DeRose in St. Louis.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 21 points. It closed at 9,200 in heavy trading of 1.7 billion shares. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 4 points to close at 1645. This is NPR News. Greek riot police fired tear gas today to disperse anarchists protesting the EU summit. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports from Porto Karos in northern Greece.
A group of about 300 anarchists broke away from several thousand marchers in a village 3 miles north of the heavily protected resort where the EU summit is taking place. Helmeted police wearing gas masks pushed stone-throwing anarchists into the pine woods. Another group of 5,000 demonstrators were traveling by bus from Thessalonica, 70 miles north of the summit site. Under plans negotiated weeks ago between local authorities and demonstrators' representatives, a soccer field had been made available for speeches. Very tight security is in place. 16,000 soldiers and police are on hand. Surface-to-air missiles are in place, and naval ships patrol the waters. The measures are seen as a dress rehearsal for the Summer Olympics next year in Athens. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Porto Karos.
Civil rights leader Jesse Jackson led a march through Benton Harbor, Michigan today. The city was shaken by two nights of rioting earlier this week after a black motorcyclist was killed in a crash as he fled from white police officers. Jackson said the incident can be a chance to demand better opportunities for the city's mostly black residents.
We want to turn this tragic death, we'll turn this crisis into an opportunity. For in some sense today, the eyes of the nation are upon Benton Harbor.
Jackson compared Benton Harbor with the mostly white city of St. Joseph, just across the river. He said St. Joseph, which is relatively prosperous, should do more to help its neighbor cope with poverty and unemployment. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, whose latest Kids Count data book focuses on the high cost of being poor at www.kidscount.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Our guests, Chris Collingwood and Adam Schlesinger, are the co-founders of the New Jersey rock band Fountains of Wayne. In a review of their new album, Welcome Interstate Managers, Tom Keelty of the Boston Globe called the band one of rock's most literate acts. Let's hear a song from the new album. This is Hackensack.
We sat together in period one, Fridays at 8:15. Now I see your face in the strangest places, movies and magazines. I saw you talking to Christopher Walken on my TV screen. But I will wait for you as long as Hackensack, I'll be here for you.
Adam Schlesinger received an Academy Award nomination for writing the title song for Tom Hanks' movie That Thing You Do. Terry spoke to Schlesinger and Chris Collingwood in 1999 after the release of their second album, Utopia Parkway. They talked about the roots of Fountains of Wayne.
We played in a series of bands together before we even started Fountains of Wayne. I mean, we've been playing together in one form or another since we were 18. And the stuff that we did originally was more kind of, I don't know how to describe it. I mean, less rock and more pop maybe, you know. And I think that's where this record has gone. So in a weird way, it feels like kind of back to our roots. I mean, when we made our first album, we went into a studio with a Marshall amplifier and just made a lot of noise. And we had never really recorded anything like that before. And so to us, you know, it was like this big rock extravaganza. And although it probably doesn't sound like that to your average teenager, it probably sounds like a wimpy pop band. But on this record, we wanted to have, you know, different kinds of textures on the record, some subtler stuff, some slightly more introspective stuff mixed in with the kind of jokey, fun, loud stuff.
Well, don't sell that first album short. I really like it. And
oh, I don't mean it that way. I mean, the first album was just, it was written in about a week, it was recorded in about another week, and it was just this kind of blast of energy, and I think it's great. I think it's a, you know, it's the perfect way to approach a first record, just have a good time and, you know, create this kind of blueprint for yourself. but we wanted to try to expand on that a little bit and not just do the same thing again.
When that record came out, when your first record came out, rock critic Robert Christgau said that that he thinks you sing the kind of words every shy guy who didn't get the girl thinks of. And I think a good illustration of that point is the song Leave the Biker, which is a really catchy song. Why don't we play that? This is Leave the Biker from the first Fountains of Wayne CD.
Seems the further from town I go, the more I hate this place. He's got leather and big tattoos, scars all over his face. And I wonder if he ever has cried, 'cause he couldn't get a date for the prom. He's got his arm around every man's dream, and crumbs in his beard from the seafood special. Oh, can't you see my world is falling apart? Baby, please leave the biker, leave the biker, break his heart. Baby, please
the biker, leave the biker, break his heart. Now his friend leans over and says, looks like we got us a fag. I wonder if that guy's read one word that wasn't in a porno mag. And I wonder if he ever has cried. His kitten got run over and died. He's got his arm around every man's dream. Crumbs in his beard from the seafood special. Oh, can't you see my world is falling apart? Baby, please leave the biker, leave the biker, break his heart. Baby, please leave the biker, leave the biker, break his heart.
That's from the first Fountains of Wayne CD. Do you think Robert Krisko was onto something? Do you think of yourselves as former Shy Guys who didn't get the girl?
I think there's a lot made out of that, actually. And it's funny because...
Too much, you mean?
Well, I think that if people are really eager to call you geek rock or whatever, it sort of lumps you into this convenient category, which ignores the subtler aspects of some of the songwriting, which...
Not that that's the most subtle song that we've ever put out.
Right, right. And you know, I mean, to some degree, it might have been a mistake to put that song on the record, because I'd hate to sort of go down in history as this joke songwriter. And
oh, but it's catchy. I don't think I think it's a good song.
No, it is, and I mean, I think the thing is that, you know, obviously that song's supposed to be fun, and a lot of them are, but at the same time, you know, people, especially in America, I think more so even than in Europe, assume that any voice that you have in a song is you confessing, you know, your inner thoughts, and the idea of writing from like the perspective of a character or something is a little bit confusing to people.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times there's songs written that are not literally supposed to be us speaking our minds, and that sometimes gets missed.
Well, there's nice lines in the song, like the line about the guy having crumbs in his beard from the seafood special.
I think the main thing with that whole sort of geeky sort of tag or whatever is that neither of us would be comfortable writing a song that had a really kind of macho aggressive pose to it. It definitely does come more naturally to us to write from like a weaker perspective, and maybe it's just because it makes the song more sympathetic or something.
Well, there's that line, I wonder if he's ever cried because he couldn't get a date for the prom. And then there's a prom song on your new CD also that I think is kind of mocking that stereotyped emotion you're supposed to have on the prom, like, this is the crowning moment of my life, and after this I'm going to, like, have a receding hairline and, you know,
right,
just work all the time and life will be over. It's like the oldest cliche in the book about how you're supposed to feel on prom night.
Yeah, I actually went to two high school proms. I went to my own, and then I went to the prom at the high school where my girlfriend at the time went out on Long Island, and they were both pretty much identical, these kind of suburban proms. And even though I was only, whatever, 17 at the time, I was already too cynical to enjoy it. So I kind of ruined it for both of us. And she never really forgave me, you know. I think that was the beginning of the end of our relationship.
Did you play a lot of proms?
No, but we actually wanted to do that now. We're talking about, you know, trying to get some proms on our tour schedule for this year.
You're kidding, right?
No, I'm not kidding.
Why would you want to do that?
Because we're a really good cover band, although we don't like to admit it, but we always end up playing a lot of covers, and you know, I think it would be fun.
What do you cover?
Anything people
Everything.
Yell out. We played a show in Seattle, or Portland, Oregon, I think it was, actually, on our last tour, where we ended up doing one Billy Joel song for every one of our songs. So by the end of the night, I think we had done, you know, 10 or 12 Billy Joel songs, none of which we had ever played before, but...
Actually, that the funny thing about that is, like, I found that online about 6 months later. It became this sort of legendary thing, like in some news group that was like,
they had the set list,
huge big discussion.
Then they did Just a Fantasy, and then they did, you know, Allentown. It was great.
How did you first meet? You've been playing together a long time.
Yeah, we met in college. We were both, I think, about 19 at the time. We've sort of been playing steadily in bands ever since then. We had about 10 different bands throughout since about 1987
Six or seven, yeah.
To the present, most of which were incredibly terrible, and they all had really horrible names. And we actually
such as
We used to change our name, you know, once a week.
Because people who saw us once, like if we advertised with the same name, they'd never come back. We were called Woolly Mammoth.
That was about a...
Three people who, when standing side by side, have a wingspan of over 12 feet.
Are you my mother?
Are you my mother?
What did you call the band that?
That's a children's book, actually.
Green Light Go is another children's book.
The silly thing is that Fountains of Wayne was just one of these, in the pile of names that we would just kind of rotate, and that ended up being the one that we got stuck with. But I kind of prefer Are You My Mother, actually. Maybe we should switch it.
Well, how did you come up with Fountains of Wayne, and why is that the name that stuck?
Fountains of Wayne is a store in the town called Wayne, New Jersey, which is near where I grew up. And I think it was something that my mother actually suggested at some point. I mean, she works in Clifton.
That was about 10 years ago.
Yeah, while we were probably...
While we were tossing around all these bad band names.
And she was always full of, really horrible ideas for, things we should do to help the band out. So she would suggest these terrible names, and we'd say, oh, God, that's a horrible band name. And she would also say things like... Why don't you guys play shows where you have two pianos on stage and you can both play piano and that'll be your gimmick? and I just say, I really don't have time to explain why that's a bad idea right now, but at some point I will.
My family was always saying, why don't you go on that David Letterman show? That seems to do those bands a lot of good.
Was she offering to get you on?
Yeah. No, she just, that was her idea for promotion.
I want to play another recording from your first CD, and this is called She's Got a Problem. I think this is also a really good song. Would you say anything about writing it? Which of you wrote this one?
I wrote it, although Chris had the title, and I kind of took the title and wrote a song around it. I mean, one thing that we did early on a lot was to just sit down and kind of throw out possible song titles, and then it was almost a game to see if who could turn it into an actual song.
Yeah, we actually sat in a bar and wrote them on bar napkins. I don't know if you still have those, but there's.
Yeah, I have
these
a napkin
soggy
with
napkins.
With like 50 possible titles, and most of the songs on our first album are on there somewhere. And then there's a bunch of really bad ones that we couldn't even bring ourselves to write. So yeah, I mean, She's Got a Problem. Funnily enough, was a song that I had sort of been working on a little bit, and when Chris suggested that title, I kind of grafted it onto this idea that I had. Rolling around.
Girl who should never be alone. I know a girl who should never be alone. She's a danger to herself, and I'm worried about her health. She's got a
That She's Got a Problem from Fountains of Wayne's first album. We're listening to Terry's 1999 interview with the band's co-founders, Chris Collingwood and Adam Schlesinger. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1999 interview with Adam Schlesinger and Chris Collingwood, the founders of the band Fountains of Wayne. After their first album, they expanded the band to include drummer Brian Young of the Posies and guitar player Jody Porter.
When you wanted to expand the band, did you find the people you wanted to play with in an organic way, or did you actually hold auditions and so on?
We actually tried to hold auditions, didn't we?
Oh, my God, it was the most ludicrous thing you've ever seen.
We put an ad in the Village Voice or something, and just, I think we met every horrible musician in the New York area. And it's just, I can't even begin to tell you how funny those auditions are.
I think there are people who just make a career out of going to rock auditions, and you can probably tell, like, the guys who showed up, you know, it's their fifth one that day. I can't understand why things aren't going right for them.
Well, did you tell them what you wanted to hear, or would they just come up with like an audition piece and perform it for you?
Well, most of the time they had a copy of a demo or something, and we're kind of like learn this song and just, you know, wing it, whatever. So they'd show up and plug in, and they'd leave, and we'd laugh, and
then the next guy would come in. Yeah, I mean, as it turned out, you know, that proved futile really quickly, and so Jody, the guitar player, was someone that I knew because he was the leader of a band for a long time called the Bell Tower, and I had actually played bass for his band briefly. And then Brian, we actually met through a friend of ours who knew Brian from his work with the Posies, and we had never met him, but he just came down. We actually auditioned him in Los Angeles, but the audition was really just kind of a free-for-all
getting together and playing Blue Oyster Cult songs.
Yeah, and Steve Miller covers and things. I mean, we knew kind of instantly that he was the right guy, and if it's just whether he wanted to do it or not, we just had a good time playing.
Brian's kind of the rock star in the group, actually. Like, everywhere we go in Europe, everybody's like, they know the Posies really well. So
he's the touring veteran. Him. He was kind of showing us the ropes as we went.
Some people who don't even know that it's Brian in the band will show up and recognize his drum kit, and they say,
wow.
You know, did you guys buy the Posies drum kit? We're like, no.
So what's the best advice he gave you on weathering a tour?
Well, you know, his whole philosophy is whenever you start complaining too much, you got to just remember that it beats flipping eggs. That's his expression. You know, you can be sitting in some, you know, train station in Germany for 8 hours, and he can say, well, it beats flipping eggs.
That's probably not bad advice.
No.
So, sometimes it doesn't beat flipping eggs.
That's right.
It's the
actually,
one thing he forgot.
Flipping eggs might be kind of fun right about now.
Adam, I have a question for you. You wrote that song, That Thing You Do, for the Tom Hanks movie. And
I thought
that was a surprisingly good movie that had a really kind of knowing and loving sense of 60s pop. How did you come to write the song? Was there like a national audition being held for the song? Or
not really. I mean, it was just somebody in the music business that I work with at a music publishing company heard about the movie and said that, you know, they were looking for a song that kind of sounded like this era, and asked me if I wanted to take a stab at it. So I did a demo recording of it with two friends, and we just sent it in. And, you know, we did it really quickly because we just kind of assumed it was such a long shot. It wasn't worth spending that much time on. But, you know, they actually listened to it, and they actually liked it. So it was a lucky break.
Yeah, and the movie is about a band that's a one-hit wonder, and the only hit that they have is this song, That Thing You Do. And it's a really catchy record. What did you think about when you wrote this song, knowing that it needed to be a period song?
Well, the obvious reference for the time period they were talking about was the Beatles, but they actually had, as part of the instructions for it, had said that, you know, we'd rather have it sound like an American band that's, you know, kind of a cheap imitation of the Beatles, you know, because there were a lot of bands sprouting up then.
The Knickerbockers.
Yeah, that kind of stuff, you know, trying to capitalize on what the Beatles had done. So that's what I was going for.
Okay. Well, this is your song, That Thing You Do. Your knowledge of rock and pop goes back a long way, and I'm wondering, what do you remember the first records you each bought?
I think the first full-length LP I was ever allowed to buy was Bat Outta Hell by Meat Loaf. My parents obviously had all those Beatles records sitting around and stuff, but I remember, I think I was in sixth grade when Bat Outta Hell came out. It was that record.
You were like,
and,
whoa.
Yeah, a really cool. That motorcycle on the cover was just so excellent.
The first record I ever bought was this exercise record that they made us buy in first grade. It was called Chicken Fat.
We had to listen to that record? Too. Yeah.
It was like push-ups every morning.
10 times.
Not just now and then. 10 times.
1, 2.
And they'd make you exercise to it, and then they'd also make you buy it.
It would give that chicken right back, give that chicken fight back to the chicken, and don't be chicken again.
I can't believe you're the only person I've ever mentioned this to that knows what the hell I'm talking about.
I want to know what kind of fascist elementary school you went to. Chicken fight.
Chicken fat.
Oh, it was this really funny...
All the weak students. The strong students will survive.
Kill the weak.
Oh, it was this military-style workout record, yeah. Oh,
that's man. Just horrible.
So you really liked it? This is an influence on your music?
I never said I liked it.
And tell me again why you brought it up.
You asked us the first record we ever bought.
Oh, and they made you buy it.
Oh, yeah, it was forced purchase.
That's right.
I should suggest to our record company that strategy of forcing first graders to buy our album. Because there's a lot of first graders out there, you know, and they've all got lunch money.
That's a good idea.
We could just go rob them instead of making them buy the record.
Yeah, why bring this whole record thing into it?
Chris Colligwood and Adam Schlesinger, co-founders of the band Fountains of Wayne. They spoke with Terry in 1999. They have a new album, Welcome Interstate Managers. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air. Let's hear Stacy's Mom.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com, and from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, A Ship Made of Paper. We talk with Scott Spencer about his latest novel of romantic love and obsession. Also, The Technicolor World of Bing Crosby, now out on DVD, and Ang Lee's film adaptation, The Hulk, now playing in theaters.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Not every movie musical has great musical numbers, but some great numbers come from mediocre movies. That's what classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz discovered when he watched a series of new DVDs starring Bing Crosby.
Some pretty obscure movie musicals have just come out on DVD. A series of Bing Crosby films that I was afraid would never appear. DVD is the perfect format for them because you can skip over the corny plots and go directly to the musical numbers, several of which are among the best that Hollywood ever produced. Take, for example, the two Irving Berlin musicals Crosby made with Fred Astaire, Holiday Inn and Blue Skies. In both films, these beloved stars are romantic rivals. The films emphasize some of their least attractive qualities, self-importance and jealousy. They insult and one-up each other. In their duets, each one tries to prove he's better than the other, or that singing is better than dancing, or vice versa. But in their solos, they're at their very best. In Holiday Inn, Crosby sings his biggest hit, White Christmas. And in Blue Skies, Astaire dances his most iconic solo, Puttin' on the Ritz, complete with top hat, tails, spats, and a cane, which he taps as if he had an extra leg. Astaire was always a kind of magician. In Puttin' on the Ritz, he uses his cane as a magic wand. Is he casting a spell? He drops it on the floor, steps on it, in rhythm, of course, to assert his power over it. Then it leaps back up into his hand. He pushes open a curtain hiding two mirrors, then pushes open the mirrors into Wonderland, a stage where nine miniature cane-tapping Astaires, thanks to trick photography, are also in his power, as are we all.
Have you seen the well-to-do up and down Park Avenue on that famous thoroughfare with their noses in the air? High hats and arrow collars, white spats and lots of dollars, spending every dime for a wonderful time. Now if you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits? Puttin' on the Ritz.
Blue Skies is on a double feature DVD with another Crosby vehicle, Birth of the Blues, a low-budget, black-and-white movie Hollywoodizing the origins of Dixieland jazz. Crosby's co-star is Broadway's legendary Mary Martin, who made only a few movies between her 1938 Broadway debut, Singing My Heart Belongs to Daddy, and her starring role a decade later in South Pacific, singing I'm Gonna Wash That Man Right Out of My Hair. Hollywood couldn't quite figure out what to do with her fragile beauty and offbeat charm. Birth of the Blues has one of her best movie moments, a duet with Crosby in Wait Till the Sun Shines, Nelly, Harry Von Tilzer's hit song from 1905. Martin starts by singing it sweet and square. Crosby gently nudges her elbow to knock her off the beat. He's teaching her syncopation. And boy, does she get it.
Wait till the sun shines, Nelly, when the clouds go drifting by. We will be so happy, Nelly.
Don't let me hear you sighing.
Can't stand to see you crying, darling.
Down Lover's Lane we'll wander,
sweetheart, you and I.
If you will wait
at the garden
till
gate.
The sun
now, honey, don't be late.
Bye,
in the sweet bye, by and by.
A special treat in Birth of the Blues are rare appearances by the great jazz trombonist Jack Teagarden and Ruby Elzey, who created the role of Serena in Porgy and Bess. Here she sings a heartbreaking version of St. Louis Blues.
Tree.
One of the series of these new Crosby DVDs has two Technicolor musicals, the goofy Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, and a very peculiar film, The Emperor Waltz, the only musical ever directed by Billy Wilder, if you don't count Some Like It Hot as a full-fledged musical. It's a manufactured Viennese operetta putting new words to music by Johann Strauss and Richard Heuberger. Crosby plays a traveling salesman who's pushing a new invention, the phonograph. He could have used a good singing or dancing partner, but he got Joan Fontaine as a haughty countess who succumbs to his American brashness. But an earlier Crosby film, Rhythm on the Range, is the source of my favorite cowboy song, Johnny Mercer's brilliant parody, I'm an Old Cowhand.
I spend all my time at the hotel bar with a Planters punch and a big cigar, cause my old ranch horse is a movie star.
Yippee-i-o, ki-yay, oh, yippee-i-o, ki-yay, she's an old cowgirl, just a regular cow.
They don't call me Emma, they just call me Al. Where's the gosh darn horsey around our way? We don't say howdy, we just say hey. We don't answer, we all just
nay.
Rhythm on the Range also marked the movie debut of Martha Raye. She sings several verses of I'm an Old Cowhand, as well as the song that became her signature, the raucously swinging Mr. Paganini. The rest of the movie is pretty silly, so I've become very good at using the DVD chapter index. It's easier than programming a VCR, and it's definitely a skill worth learning.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music critic for the Boston Phoenix.
Mr. Paganini, and now don't be a meanie, but have you up your sleeve, come on, and let's bring it. And if you can't bring it, you'll simply have to not do, not do, not do that.
Coming up, novelist Scott Spencer. This is Fresh Air. Scott Spencer is the author of the new novel, A Ship Made of Paper. The story is about two couples, one white, one African American. The white couple, Daniel and Kate, pride themselves on their moderation in everything, until Daniel falls in love with Iris, an African American woman who is married and has a child. A Ship Made of Paper and Spencer's earlier novel, Endless Love, are both stories about obsession. This is how our book critic Maureen Corrigan describes Spencer's work. Though the love stories Spencer writes about are typically out of control, his writing never is. He's such a precise and lyrical writer that feelings experienced, but possibly never expressed in language before, materialize in his words. Terry spoke with Scott Spencer this spring.
Your new novel, A Ship Made of Paper, and your earlier novel, Endless Love, are about a certain type of love, a certain type of obsessive love. You're not only in love with someone, but your whole life kind of falls into the background as you pursue this passion. And in both novels, the character pursuing this passion kind of falls off the edge, and things around him just get inadvertently destroyed. What is your interest in that type of obsessive love?
Well, you know, Endless Love has been a blessing for me. I mean, it supported me as a writer for many years and supported my family for many years. And I sort of kept away from that subject for a long time because, you know, I don't want to become like the Barry White or the Johnny Mathis of literature. But the fact is, I do really enjoy writing about these things, things that can be loosely categorized under the heading of love. But you know what some readers may choose to overlook, however, is that my view of this romantic and sexual impulse in my characters is always ambivalent. Like the hero of Endless Love, one reader pointed out to me, is, and I think quite correctly, is he's a stalker. And the protagonist in Waking the Dead only really loves his lover after she's disappeared, when she's literally been exploded. And Daniel Emerson in A Shipmate of Paper, part of his love for Iris Davenport is sort of shot through with a kind of annihilating naivete. And you know, even though he's willing to do anything in the world to be with her, he's willing to do damage to others, and he's also, I think, to his credit, willing to have damage done to him. So I become curious, you know, what is it? Is love an ennobling emotion, or is it somehow like a debasing emotion? And I come up with the answer that it's both. But it's also something else. It's that something that animates us. It lights the fuse that leads right to our explosive core. And I think I wanted to write about this now because I have like the good fortune to have love come back into my life at the unseemly age of 50-something. I began writing this novel when I began living with this writer named Joanne Beard, the essayist Joanne Beard, you know, who's not very much like the woman in this novel. She's white, she's from Illinois, and she's not like Iris at all. But falling in love with Joanne and living with her gave me the energy to throw myself into a story of heedless passion. And I figured, hey, why not?
One of the things I love about your writing is your kind of ease with analogies. They just are always so good and often so funny. And even when the sentiment that somebody's expressing isn't really funny at all, suddenly this like funny image will set in. After this long list of things that have gone wrong in Daniel's life, and then he concludes by saying that he's actually never been happier, he has this description of erotic love, which I'd like you to read.
Much of this happiness is purely physical. It is an animal joy, a stunning, erotic completeness such as he has never experienced. Daniel had always secretly believed that people who went on about their sexual happiness were exaggerating. They were like those restaurant reviewers who compare a bowl of soup to a glimpse of heaven. They were sexual gourmets. They were like those wine critics who justify their expense account indulgences with words that not only elevated their simple human pleasures into some bold adventure of the senses, but also claimed to be extracting arcane nuances of pleasures that only they could discern.
And Daniel realizes he has now become one of those people. Yeah. But I thought that analogy to like a certain type of food writer and wine critic was perfect, and also helped me crystallize what I don't like about a certain type of food writing and wine criticism. And I these analogies seem to just come to you. I bet you don't really struggle over them.
That's not the hard part of writing for me. That's not the hard part.
The hard part is what?
The hard part is getting people in and out of rooms, just making the story move in an interesting way, and the psychology of the characters.
A couple of your novels have been made into screenplays, and you've written some screenplays yourself. Was there ever any thought in the back of your mind as you were writing A Ship Made of Paper of maybe one day this will be a movie?
Well, this book took me well over 4 years to write, so I don't think there's any thought that didn't go through my mind.
You had plenty of time.
That maybe I would be canonized then. Or would have to maybe go back to college, maybe perhaps go to law school or something. So I can't say that it never occurred to me, but it doesn't seem like a good thing to think when you're working on a book. it doesn't seem like a lucky thing to think. It doesn't seem like it would be good for the book. And I certainly didn't dwell on it.
When it takes you 4 years to write a novel, how do you stop from losing confidence during those 4 years? It's such a long time. I do a show every day. One show isn't very good. There's another one tomorrow. It's kind of like starting with a clean slate every day. The thought of a four-year-long project in which there's nothing that's complete until the end of that process, I would find that terrifying.
Well, I do find it pretty terrifying. And in the course of writing this particular book, I lost confidence in it quite a number of times. And again, I have the fortune of living with another writer who's really encouraging. And I don't know what I do to allow myself to keep going on. Sometimes I'll show pages to friends and they say, "Oh, that's very nice," and that gives me enough. And sometimes it's just the memory that this is what it's like when you're lost in the wilderness of a book, and you just keep taking one little step after another, and sooner or later you come out. And it's also, it doesn't always work out.
Right. When you were a kid, did you write poems or stories?
Yeah, I did. I did. I wrote my first novel when I was 9 years old.
What was it about?
It was about a horse. It was about a horse who was forced into service in the German army, in the North African desert, and escaped from the Nazis and was rescued by an American film crew that was making one of those Foreign Legion movies starring Buster Crabbe. And the horse galloped onto the set, and they adopted it.
That's really funny. You certainly weren't following the old adage, write what you know.
No, that's what I knew. That's what I was allowed to talk about anyhow.
Well, why do you think you wrote? Is that what you thought novels should be about?
Well, I suppose it reminded me a little bit of what I had read or what I wanted to read, and it seemed incredibly exciting to me.
It's funny how far you've come from that, since most of your fiction is so much about internal matters, like adventures of the heart, not of like a horse who's scripted into the German army or whatever.
Yes. But if I do write that book, would you have me back on?
I'll have you read the whole thing out loud.
All right. This is the shot in the arm that I need.
After the fourth draft, you can come on.
Well, I think as a kid, and maybe this is a gender thing, I had no idea what my internal life was like. And as far as I'm concerned, I had none.
Huh. Weren't falling in love or liking yourself up in the room and thinking things you didn't want to share with other people? And
falling in love, but not doing an awful lot of thinking.
Huh.
Not doing an awful lot of thinking.
That's odd, because your characters have pretty thorough internal lives. I mean, and especially the ones that are first-person narrators, they have to.
Well, yeah, but that came much later for me.
Mm-hmm.
That came, unless I've just forgotten it all, but I can't think of a thought that I had until I was 12 years old.
What changed when you were 12?
I don't know. I guess, you go through physical changes, you start, I don't know what changed when I was 12.
Puberty made you introspective?
I think puberty put me in contact with a better class of girl or something. I think that I'm one of those men who was really introduced to himself by girls.
That
my drive toward them finally led me back to myself, because that's what they were interested in.
I mean, that they were interested in people as opposed to adventure, or
they were interested in people as opposed to adventure, exactly. And they were also interested in relating,
right,
on a more intimate and psychological way. And as far as I'm concerned, yeah, sure. You want to do that? I can do that.
Scott Spencer's latest novel is A Ship Made of Paper. Coming up, The Hulk. This is Fresh Air. Arthouse filmmaker Ang Lee directs the big-budget adaptation of the Marvel comic book The Incredible Hulk. The movie features newcomer Eric Bana with Jennifer Connelly, Nick Nolte, and a computer-generated monster whose face was modeled on Ang Lee's. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Hulk must be seen to be disbelieved. This $150 million Marvel Comics adaptation is not Ang Lee's big sellout. It's actually a serious... make that a deadly serious Frankenstein movie about an even more modern Prometheus and his genetically enhanced son. It has jacked-up comic book visuals, a strange claymation-like creature at the center, and a tone that's like a gloomy rewrite of Aeschylus, the sins of the father visited upon the unwitting son. In places, it's hypnotically bad, but it is hypnotic. In the script by John Turman, Michael France, and Lee's longtime collaborator James Shamus, the scientist Bruce Banner isn't just pelted by gamma rays so that he turns into the Hulk when he gets angry. Those rays now interact with his already mutant DNA, which was passed down by a mad scientist dad who experimented on himself when those churlish army officers wouldn't let him use human subjects. Bruce's egghead ex-girlfriend, Betty, played by Jennifer Connelly, explains that his anger triggers his new nanomeds, and that it's all connected to repressed memories that have something vaguely to do with his dad, his dead mom, and a butcher knife. Very mysterious. She points out that physical trauma can heal, but emotions go on and on. But Eric Bana's Bruce is locked in a puny kind of way. He's a little peevish, and he looks like Griffin Dunn crossed with Bill Murray. When he describes his Hulk experience to Betty as both horrifying and liberating, he doesn't seem especially horrified or liberated, just out of breath.
Oh, God. It must be the nanomeds. It must be the gamma exposure, but we've never seen any effect like this before.
No, deeper. The gamma just unleashed what was already there.
Unleashed what?
Me. It.
It's okay.
Lee overcompensates for the central vacuum by giving the movie a speed freak syntax that shows the influence of the TV series 24, which can make you sick with suspense. But in Hulk, it's just a lot of fancy pants split screens and boxes within boxes and punchy zoom backs from things like frog's eyes. When Bruce starts to change into the Hulk, you get montages of reptiles and jellyfish and H-bombs going off. And then you get, well, before the movie was even screened, I heard the computer-generated Hulk described as Shrek on steroids, and I wish I could add to that. All he needs is a donkey sidekick. The decision to make the Hulk entirely computer-generated has its pluses and minuses. He no longer looks like an over-caffeinated seasick bodybuilder. He's now the size of King Kong, which means more rock'em sock'em spectacle, but less honest-to-goodness fighting. And that's too bad, because the best thing about Ang Lee's Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon was the way that Lee managed to infuse his action sequences with a kind of psychosexual fury, so that the battle seemed like volcanic punchlines to matters that couldn't be settled over cups of tea. Here, when the Hulk starts flinging around tanks and punching out helicopters, the movie resembles a lot of anonymous Japanese giant monster pictures from the 60s, especially the one that in the U.S. was called Frankenstein Conquers the World, which featured a boy getting zapped by radiation and turning into a long-haired green giant. The Hulk has some cool powers, though. He's massive, but he bounces around like Tigger in Winnie the Pooh. He goes boing, boing, boing across the California desert. Actually, he doesn't boing, he kabooms. Every time he lands, you think the plaster's going to rain down from the ceiling. The Hulk's broad face was modeled on Ang Lee himself, and he and Connolly's Betty are supposed to have this King Kong Beauty and the Beast sort of bond. There's a great visual moment when she sees him for the first time, blending in with the green tendrils outside her cabin in a redwood forest. It's too bad she has to say, "Bruce?" and bring down the house. It's not the first thing that would pop out of most people's mouths when they saw a 30-foot giant. Betty's dad, played by Sam Elliott, is a general who wants to finish off the Hulk, but he's not an evil man, especially next to Josh Lucas as a scientist for the Atheon Corporation. He'd like to patent the Hulk and create a sort of uber-soldier, and especially not next to the movie's other dad, played by a twitchy and bedraggled Nick Nolte, who looks the way he did in that famous DUI mugshot. In the climax, he rails at his shackled son against a deep black backdrop. We could be in San Francisco's Magic Theater, with Sam Shepard standing in the wings. Unlike your average comic book blockbuster, Hulk isn't a bad cartoon. It's a bad Greek tragedy, and hence deserves our admiration, along with our mirth.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Seuss Boland directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Elegant Gathering of White Snows, a novel about eight women whose impromptu walking quest touches a nation by Chris Radish. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, singer-songwriter Roseanne Cash. Her latest CD, Rules of Travel, features new songs, including a duet with her father, Johnny Cash. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Will you remember me like the circled stones on the ancient hills where you walk alone, where the wind